BCFM 93.2 plays more Bristol music than any other station. You can count on us to put Bristol music first.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. I don't know what happened to the 5 o'clock news. That's a complete mystery. But after the 6 o'clock news, another exclusive in an investigation here of dirty deals done by the US and British governments at the end of World War II with the Nazis. Are they still supposed to be fighting them? Did James Bond author Ian Fleming, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, his mysterious assistant Desmond Morton, Lord Louis Mountbatten, even King George VI all do deals for the Nazis' looted billions? This week, Jill Golding never knew what her grandfather Harold did in World War II until she opened an attaché case in her loft and found scores of secret documents which prove her grandfather Harold was one of the greatest heroes of World War II. So why, despite his being commanding officer of the Special Boat Service, awarded a DSO medal, did veterans groups and historians refuse to recognise him? And why did he die just months after the end of the war? Also in Canada, the 9/11 consensus panel is planning to force a debate in the Canadian Parliament about what really happened in New York and Washington on September the 11th, 2001. And Shredded, it's the FT's recommended book of last year, all about Fred the Shred and his bank we are supposed to own. She's still refusing to lend money to many people and taking perfectly good businesses apart to asset strip them. I'm joined by financial journalist and author Ian Fraser. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. To our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 1 Celsius, just about above freezing, dry but icy. Highs of 5 Celsius this weekend, possible wintry showers, thunder and sunny spells. Next week, highs of 5 Celsius, more windy showers possible and also sunny spells. Next weekend, 24th and 25th of January, highs of 5 and sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles. Hi, Fabian. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself first, Fabian. What got you interested in politics in the first place?
I've always been interested in politics, I suppose, even as a kid, but I suppose what got me active was I thought it was the run-up to the 92 election, and I thought if I don't get my finger out and actually try and do something about changing the government, then I have to accept the blame if the then Tory government got back in. And I actually signed my application form the night we lost the 92 election, but I don't regret it. It's a question of get in there and get involved, or otherwise you're just a spectator, and I'm a natural activist. I can't just sit on the sidelines and moan. I need to get my hands dirty and get involved.
Well, the Labour Party was in power for the best part of 10 years, but still things aren't working very well, are they? And also, the Labour Party during that time under Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, actually introduced many of the things like the beginning of the privatisation of the National Health Service, PFIs, this kind of thing, that are now many people are pointing to as the root of many of our present problems.
I think we've got to be careful here, because what's happened with the NHS is that Dave Cameron basically lied to us. He said there wasn't going to be any major top-down reorganisations of the NHS, and we had £3 billion blown in a enforced top-down reorganisation. When Labour left office in 2010, user satisfaction in the NHS was at an all-time high, now it's at an all-time low. The NHS is deliberately being torn apart. It's deliberately being sold off. hence all this business with the TTIP, with people petitioning to ensure and campaigning to stop the NHS being being part of that, because obviously if we end up with a situation where American businesses can sue governments if government decisions affect their profits, then we've got basically lost control of public services, which is crazy.
TTIP comes up again and again, doesn't it? Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It's certainly been talked about a lot more over the last 6 months or so than it was previously. But ultimately, there's a lot of fingers pointing at Labour right now as to being the root of some of these present problems. I come back to beginning outsourcing at the National Health Service was the start of this creeping privatisation that we're now seeing really hitting crisis levels with problems at accident and emergency and a lack of funding altogether.
The original plan, certainly when Blair and introduced or started introducing sort of private provision within the NHS, it was about supplementing the public service that already existed. It wasn't a question of breaking stuff off and selling it off. It was about taking advantage of available private supply in order to cut waiting lists, in order to get people treated quickly. That's what was the intention. It's a completely different beast to what's happening now.
So what is happening now?
Government's breaking up the NHS and trying to sell it off, and it's all sort of happening behind our backs, and it's being kept out of the media. Like, there was a huge editorial conference a few years ago in Manchester. There was a massive, massive demonstration demanding the protection of the NHS and opposing the privatisation. It was completely kept out of the media. You only found out what was happening through social media.
What about a bit closer to home? Not that the NHS isn't here in Bristol, of course it is, but there's a lot of stuff going on, which is more specifically Bristol. One is the residence parking system. How do you think that's working out? Because George Ferguson, to give him credit, did say when he was first elected that he was going to get this system brought in. You, the Lib Dems and the Conservatives, for literally years and years, have been promising to do something about the awful situation for many people parking. George is now doing something about it, our mayor, and yet you're still bashing him, basically, for doing exactly what he said he'd do before he was elected.
Not quite. I mean, the problem is he's just imposing it without, there doesn't seem to be enough consultation. Now, to be honest, RPZ hasn't hit St George East yet, so I haven't seen what the proposals will be in the patch I represent.
When is it scheduled up there, do you know?
Not as yet. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the election happened, the mayoral election 22nd happened first. But, I mean, the big hoo-ha's been in Clifton and places like that.
The point being, really, that it's going to be impossible to get consensus on it. Of course, not everyone is going to agree. But George has said, look, we're going to actually get it moving. We're going to get what consensus we can and then do it. And that surely is the right approach.
I think he needs to consult more. I mean, the problem with George is he's got a reputation for, making it, just going ahead and doing whatever he feels like and not worrying too much about, changing plans if there's other views or people are unhappy about what's being proposed. He'll just go ahead and do it anyway. And that's, for something as controversial as RPZ, you need to work with people rather than dump things on people.
But, I mean, his argument, and I offer a lot of sympathy for this, is that there's been a logjam in the past because it's been impossible to get agreement. So he's just making sure it happens.
Well, the real logjam is in actually sort of, the fact that we have such a massive car dependency culture. I mean, OK, I admit I drove here tonight, but, I mean, we've got deregulated public transport, we don't have the powers that London has for transport as yet. That is the problem. If we can get the modal shift so people have a real choice about how they get about Bristol, that, I think, will take a lot of the pressure off. Yes, we do have people driving partially into Bristol and then parking in, they'll park in the road where I live and then get the bus in, or they'll park in, further out of
town
and get the bus
in. But if you can go door to door, if you've got a car, if you've got any choice with a bus or a car, you're going to choose the car, aren't you? Because you can go door to door, and also, almost certainly, you're going to be paying less in petrol than you would be on the bus, because the fares have just gone up again, haven't they?
Only the day rider has gone up, which is a bit of a nuisance.
So many people use that, don't they? Most people use the day rider.
I mean, the day rider does... I wasn't happy about the rise in the day rider because that's the cheapest way for my constituents to get in, because the St George's is just outside the three-mile boundary for the £1.50 flat
fare. As petrol prices are going down, so the ticket prices for the poorest in the city are going up. I mean, this is perverse.
I agree with you, but I read in the paper this week that apparently... I don't quite understand how this happens, but bus companies buy their fuel years ahead. So, which seems a bit perverse, because I'd be thinking you'd be trying to get the cheapest price you possibly can.
Well, we finally got round to talking about fuel prices. Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, want to bring you in here because it's become pretty clear that there is, over the last few months, that the price of oil has been going down and down and down around the world. My question to you is a pretty simple one. This all started around about last summer with the arrival on the scene in the Middle East of Islamic State, ISIS, whatever you want to call them. I would have thought at the time, because of these guys sitting on the oil fields, that the price of oil would start going up, in fact, possibly even skyrocket. But the opposite's happened. So are we buying our oil from ISIS, and are they selling it at knockdown prices? What's going on?
Under normal conditions, you would expect the price of oil to rise. But the Saudis, in particular, have determined that they are going to defend their market share by reducing the price of oil, which incidentally, of course, undermines the Russians and the Iranians, who are their main geopolitical opponents. So it's actually a rather dangerous manoeuvre, because there's a potential for it to cause... effectively, price drops in the oil industry could lead to a financial crash. But the Saudis are fairly determined on this, and they are forcing the pace.
But we're also seeing... I mean, you mentioned once or twice on here, haven't you, the Baltic Dry Index. We're also seeing copper prices going through the floor.
Yeah.
So it looks like whatever's happening in the casino economy and the figures looking good, in the real world, things are slowly grinding to a halt.
If you look at the markets this week, there's been a lot of wobbling and volatility as the penny begins to drop.
There was also the Swiss exiting from pegging their currency, the Swiss franc, to the euro, which is... How has that affected things?
Well, that was a surprise manoeuvre, and it's caused some problems in the financial market.
I noticed that just within a few hours, the Swiss franc had gone up in value 30% against other currencies. I mean, you know,
yeah,
amazing.
Well, it piles the pressure on the euro, and piles the pressure on Mario Draghi and the European Central
and
Bank to start printing money.
Well,
but of course, the German Bundesbank and German, you know, the general opinion in economic opinion in Germany is still opposed to this. So frankly, there is a potential for a crash here. And whether it happens before or after our election is a bit of a parochial take on it. But, I mean, in Britain, it will make a big difference if a crash occurs before the election in May or after the election, when a new government has been formed.
Well, with the euro sinking because of the Swiss exiting from parity, it was not parity, is it? They're pegging their currency to the euro. We're actually now looking at the euro coming down and actually possibly parity with the dollar. So $1 is worth €1.
Yeah, well, the real danger is deflation in the eurozone, and we discussed this last week, if you remember, Tony. Deflation is when prices are falling rather than rising. That sounds like a good thing, but in actual fact, it's like a lot of certain commentators have been saying, well, the oil price going down should be good for the economy, but in fact, it's all commodity prices that are going down, not just the oil price, because China's slowing down, the eurozone's slowing down, Japan's still in deflation.
But, I mean, surely if energy
so
prices...
Martin,
if energy prices are coming down, surely it's cheaper to produce things.
Yes, but...
It's cheaper to distribute things. Well, everything becomes cheaper.
But the oil price is part of all of the prices that function in the economy. It is an important price, but it's not the only function. I mean, don't forget that the fracking industry in the US, for example, which has expanded greatly over previous years, is dependent upon borrowing cheap money from the Federal Reserve in order to pay for its investments. And an oil price in the $30 to $40 range, which is what it's looking like it's going to end up as, leaves all of that industry unviable, which means that they won't pay their debts to the banks, which means that the banks then become insolvent. Well, they're already insolvent. The danger is that we could have a rerun of 2008, but on steroids. And I'm afraid nobody in the mainstream is debating about this. Everybody just presumes that somehow things will carry on as they are, and that we're debating about what we're going to do at the margin. I mean, when the government talks about having a long-term economic plan, it just makes me laugh, because basically everything can be blown out of the water in 24 hours. So having a long-term economic plan is a bit of an aspiration in those circumstances.
Okay, well, let's go over now. I mean, hopefully we're going to give you a laugh here now, Martin, because we're going to hear from George Osborne and his announcement on Tuesday this week that inflation is down to 0.5%, which he certainly sees as a success.
We have the lowest inflation in modern times. We have family budgets going further, and we're starting to see economic recovery being widely felt. That's welcome news for Britain. We have frozen fuel duty in this Parliament. That is one of the reasons why people see the benefit of lower inflation at the petrol pump. It's part of welcome news today that inflation is at its lowest level in modern times. Family budgets are going further. Economic recovery is starting to be widely felt. Of course, we've got to stay vigilant to make sure that we have low inflation for the right reasons. But today is further proof that our long-term plan is working.
Well, there we are, the long-term plan. The dreaded long-term plan was mentioned. I mean, the danger for George Osborne is that the economy comes off the boil before May, even if it doesn't crash. So that the housing market, for example, seems to be running out of steam. And what tends to happen when things run out of steam is they don't just mark time, they start to go backwards. And of course there's all sorts of external shocks, like the Swiss manoeuvre, geopolitical tensions over Ukraine or Syria, the Japanese, but most people have forgotten about them, but their economy is in serious trouble. All of these things could derail whatever plans the government has got. And of course, the fact that inflation is coming down is a symptom of the fact that you're getting deflation in the Eurozone, who are our major trading partners. And if anybody in the Conservative Party or UKIP thinks that Britain is going to benefit from a crash in the Eurozone, they are severely deluded.
Isn't much of this lowering of inflation and even deflation due to this oil prices? I mean, surely that has quite a big influence on it.
It is, but as you mentioned earlier, Tony, other commodities are also going down in price, and the Baltic Dry Index, which basically is what it costs to hire ships to transport things, that's been going down for several months, and that's a very good lead indicator. Before the crash in 2008, the Baltic Dry Index started to go downwards. I think all of the signs, as David Cameron said when he came back from Australia from the G20, the red lights are flashing on the dashboard of the world economy, and that's a bit of an understatement.
Just looking at the latest Baltic Dry Index, falling to 749 points, down about 8 points in a day. So it's chugging downwards, yeah, gently. Now, none of this, it seems, Fabian, is good news for the economy generally, but at least we've got low inflation, so people's spending at least is, for example, on things like energy bills, that kind of thing, is levelling off.
Yeah, but the problem is we've had inflation that has risen higher than wages for the last 4.5 years. So the cost of there's been a real cost of living crisis, and people are about £1,600 a year worse off than they were in 2010. Also, I mean, with the whole issue of deflation, the problem with the deflationary situation is rather than buying now, people put off making purchases because they wait for the price to go down so they can get the sofa, the telly or whatever, cheaper if they leave it a few weeks.
I suppose if you're seeing fuel prices coming down, you're going to leave your petrol tank mostly on empty, aren't you? You're not going to be keeping it topped up. You're going to be thinking, well, I'll leave it for maybe another couple of weeks before I fill up and the price will have come down further.
That's possible. Also, there's the question of are the Saudis simply trying to protect their market share, or are they trying to wreck the rest of the economy?
I mean, do you think it's possible for you as Bristol councillor to keep an eye on what's going on in the wider world? Because, it does seem that, there's certainly the big financial markets, the global financial markets, have been affecting the people's ability to get work, what people are getting for their work, what they're having to pay for energy, that kind of thing, quite a lot. So is it feasible for, ordinary councillors and maybe even local MPs to really keep their eye on what's going on in the global economy and making sure for us that somehow at least the policies that they're bringing in and the budgets that they're fixing, that kind of thing, are resilient for us ordinary folk paying our council tax?
Well, we do what we can. I mean, it's obviously, as a councillor, I'm not responsible for managing the global economy. No councillor is. The government should be trying to protect the British economy. I mean, the first job of a government is to protect its own people. They don't seem to be doing a very good job of it at the moment.
Who are their own people? That's what I want to know sometimes. Who are they protecting?
They only seem to be protecting the 1%, because all during this global crash, the richest in this country have got steadily wealthier and wealthier. There's been tax cuts at the top of the economy and savage cuts at the bottom of the economy. So the poorest and the most vulnerable, the sick and the disabled, they are the ones who've been picking up the bill the bill for this so-called austerity programme.
Also, of course, we've seen the media actually not necessarily helping here with programmes like Benefit Street. And I was interested to see before Christmas on BBC Three. I wonder, I'm slightly cynical about the BBC in that because BBC Three has been condemned, basically it's going to be finishing soon, that they're actually starting to do some good show. I never used to watch it at all. And I noticed the other day, crikey, it was quite a good programme on there, and it was kicking up against programmes like Benefit Street. So anyway, here we got a clip from BBC Three from just before Christmas with Owen Jones, the independent columnist and freelance writer, talking about his views on programmes like Benefit Street.
We have Benefit Street, we don't have Tax Dodger Street, and we don't have Banker Street either. And what we've ended up, because of that...
Can we pitch them?
Because of that, we've ended up in this country with this idea that all the problems we have are because of our neighbours down the streets rather than the powerful who actually run our societies. Let's think about the fact that... We talk about benefit claimants, as this talks about. Our financial industry, it wasn't bailed out by free market dogma. It was bailed out by the state. It became the most lavished benefit claimant in Britain. Mm. They carried on paying more bonuses than all other EU countries put together. The government took the EU to court to stop them capping bonuses. More salaries than ever, not lending to small businesses. Very few conditions, but huge state support. Contrast that to benefit claimants. In the last 18 months, over a million have been benefit sanctioned. That means their benefits are stopped as a punishment for not doing what you're supposed to do to get benefits. I'll give you an example. A 60-year-old army veteran in Manchester selling poppies for the Royal Legion. Now, he was trying hard to find work, including in the supermarket he was selling poppies at. He had his benefits stopped for 3 weeks. Do you know why? Because the fact he was volunteering for the Royal Legion showed he wasn't looking hard enough to get for work. That shows one rule for them at the top, one rule for everybody else. The financial sector... I think if you had a programme about people dodging taxes whilst the rest of us have to pay ours, about bankers who plunge into economic disaster, of course you would. But that point you made over there, those 2 points, of course it's key. The media is run by a very small group of rich people who have every reason to make sure the spotlight isn't on them and it's on those at the bottom. No wonder then, according to the polls, Britons on average think 27% is lost who benefit from. But the real figure is 0.7%. But if you have programme after programme after programme hunting down the most extreme and unrepresentative people, guaranteed to make people's blood boil, you'll end up with that, and you end up with neighbour turning against neighbour rather than holding those with power to account. So that's why we have to change it.
Very little's going to get done in this country when we give so many votes to a Conservative Party who is almost bankrolled by big business. And so it's all their buddies who are getting off scot-free, as Lord Billamoria put it. So if we're putting our trust in them all the time, then nothing's ever going to get done on that front. But frankly, if UKIP think they're going to do any better on it when they're being bankrolled by millionaires as well...
Tory donors,
I think they're exactly ex-Tory donors
Labour,
who
the
are
Labour
disinterested.
Party.
And going to UKIP...
It is partly education, it's partly actually giving a platform to people who can actually talk in their own words about it on TV. So, look, most social security spending goes on pensioners who've paid in all their lives. We've got millions of working age people claiming in-work benefits because they can't afford to get by on the poverty wages they're given. So I saw something flash up, let's take on the benefits culture. Fine, let's have a living wage so we don't spend billions on tax credits. Let's let councils build housing instead of subsidising private landlords with housing benefit. The reason we have social security spending is going up under this government, despite all these cuts they keep proposing, because people's wages are going down, so they can't afford to live or to pay their rent. And if we deal with that and actually increase people's wages, then we'll stop spending less on benefits.
What people have got to realise is it is business that creates the jobs, that pay the taxes, that pay for the welfare that everyone benefits from.
Don't forget, it's not a crime to be rich, and it's not a crime to be poor.
But it is a crime to cheat your benefits, and it is a crime not to pay your taxes.
Just on the tax avoidance point, at the moment what we have are accountancy firms who go to the Treasury, help draw up the tax laws, and then tell their clients how to avoid the taxes. Imagine benefit claimants went to the Department of Work and Pensions and drew up the social security legislation. We've got to turf these people out. It's a conflict of interest. And stop having tax avoiders helping to write our law and then help their businesses avoid tax. It doesn't make any sense.
OK. Very much.
There's Owen Jones on the BBC, on BBC Three there. One of the last shows, I imagine, before it's kind of switched off, ultimately. But Martin, what about that final point he was making there? This is pretty shocking stuff, isn't it? If you've got people from these big financial services firms like KPMG actually sitting in the Treasury helping write the rules so that they know, right from the very beginning, how to help people avoid paying tax.
Well, yes, and of course, if you remember the kind of outrage there was in 2008, the financial services sector had to be bailed out with billions of taxpayers' money, and what's been happened very successfully since then is that a narrative that the real problem in the country is people on benefits has actually been allowed to run and begun to sink in.
Oh, so
and
what is the real problem?
Well, you know, the real problem is that people can't understand what's happening in the financial
so
services
sector. So what is happening?
Sector.
Get on with it. Come
well,
on.
Well, I mean, we every week talk about it, but in actual fact, it's quite complicated. It's so much easier to make COD sociology judgments about people's behaviour. I mean, if everybody on benefits was made to work in a salt mine, it wouldn't do much to solve the basic problems of the financial services sector. The financial services sector, not to put too fine a point on it, is still insolvent. Without quantitative easing, without government intervention, the private sector financial market would simply implode. It's probably going to implode anyway, and nobody in the mainstream, including the Labour front bench, are really prepared for the consequences of that.
OK, here on the ground in Bristol, though, Fabian, you're sitting on committees up at City Hall now. What committees are you sitting on? What kind of stuff have you been discussing over the past few weeks?
Well, I'm on the planning committee, and I'm also one of the planning committees. We've halved the number of planning committees because the number of developments that are happening in Bristol is actually going down. So I'm left thinking when we're told, oh, there's a economic recovery going on, I'm thinking, whose recovery? I mean, there's developments. If you look at the top right, by where the Bristol Evening Post building
Temple Way.
There's huge development sites there that, you know, I remember giving permission for an office block on one of those, or a pair of office blocks on one site. Still not there 5-6 years later. It's, you know.
But what about
whose recovery is this?
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there was a great big building. I think it was, can't remember the name of it, a big insurance company
that's
building.
That's right. Gold windows, didn't they?
Yeah, a very new building. And as soon as Gordon Brown introduced this thing saying, well, if you've got an empty building, you're going to still have to pay business rates on it, it was bulldozed. So it's just still rubble. So what's happening with those sites? Because I get the impression that whoever owns them is just simply sitting on them as an investment, like money in the bank, rather than actually using it for for any kind of useful purpose. Maybe they put a car park on it or something like that, but they're certainly not interested in having buildings on it.
It is. There is clearly a case of certain property developers sitting on land and actually using it as a bank.
But hang on,
as you
they aren't, in which case, they're not developers, are they? They're speculators.
Yeah, a lot of it is speculation. And Ed Miliband has actually said that if, you know, it will be a case of use it or lose it. You know, if you've got land to develop and you've got permission, you need to get on with it. And
so
I think
beware
that's
anyone
right.
coming through the door saying, I'm a property developer, because they're probably just a gambler that wants to buy a bit of land in the hope that it's going to go up in value. Anyway, back to local news in the Post this week. MP Charlotte Leslie is attacking Bristol City Council's spending £142,000 on gagging orders. They're buying workers' silence, she says. And fair play for Charlotte for making this point. And, you know, I don't pay my council tax for it to be spent on gagging orders. I want to know if someone is being kicked out of the council for whatever reason, bullied out, you never know. I want to hear the story. I think we all do. So Bristol North West MP Charlotte Leslie spoken out against, again, over council workers being silenced through controversial gagging orders. 10 people were paid a total of £142,300 in 2014 as part of so-called compromise agreements. Oh yes, right, so they don't call it a gagging order, they call it a compromise agreement. So beware people coming through the door waving compromise agreements. So basically these things are a bribe, aren't they, of some sort? They're basically saying we'll give you some money, but you've got to keep your mouth shut.
Well, without knowing the details, which of course is a lot harder, it's hard to say why this or that person left employment in a certain place. So it's very slightly dangerous to jump to conclusions.
But shouldn't we know? Shouldn't they be able to speak freely about what happened to them?
Yes, we should know. But I think, you know, I'm a bit cynical whenever it's Charlotte Leslie. She's always seems to be jumping on any and every bandwagon you can possibly imagine. And maybe we should look at, maybe somebody needs to do a job of work comparing all the things she's spoken out about, you know, in public, and all the things she's been in all over the Evening Post about, compare that with her voting record in Westminster. Is her voting record in Westminster consistent with what she tells us down here in Bristol?
Yeah, but can't you recognise that what she's doing here is saying that this is a waste of money, that people should not be being paid council taxpayers' money, taxpayers' money, to keep their mouths shut? That's just simply wrong.
You don't
want to say yes, do you? Martin, your thoughts?
Maybe Charlotte Leslie should be more concerned about the fact that £83 million was cut from Bristol City's finances in a three-year cut. And apparently George Osborne, if he gets back in again, he's still got 60% of his cuts to him in full. So precisely what kind of services any council, Bristol or any other council, is going to be able to provide will be a mystery to me, frankly.
What you're talking about is a figure which is several hundred times more than the figure that she's talking about here.
Yeah, but it's a bit rich, her complaining about that, when she's taking money off millions and millions of pounds off Bristol City. Her government is taking millions and millions of pounds away from Bristol council taxpayers, taking millions and millions of pounds out of our services, and using that money, as has been mentioned earlier, tax cuts for the rich, tax breaks for the rich, bailing out the financial services.
Look, if any of these people have got anything to say, they want to say it confidentially, do come and speak to me, because I'm quite happy to let the public know, and hopefully, you know, to help you avoid breaking your gagging order, because I totally disagree with this kind of practice. Martin, what's your thoughts? Charlotte's saying the big danger is that employees are effectively having their silence bought. There have been many cases, especially in the health service, where staff receive a huge sum on the condition that they stay quiet on any dodgy practices by the organisation. This is unacceptable. In the case of health, it can lead to lives being lost.
Well, yes, and of course, what's really forcing that is the trustification of the health service, whereby that money is lost and it's not replaced. In other words, there's a tendency towards secrecy because you've fragmented the service into a series of competing units.
Well, as we've heard from Daphne Havercroft, one of the hidden changes that's been brought in with foundation trust status for our hospital trusts, which spend, I think, is about £1 billion of public money every year here in Bristol, is the secrecy. And in fact, as she's been asking awkward questions, she's been expelled from the meetings when she's trying to actually get answers to questions, Daphne. There seems to be, with the City Council doing this, the health trusts doing this at the very top level, we're moving towards a state where actually the great thing about much of this public service work, which is the fact that it's accountable, in other words, members of the public can come up and watch what's going on at meetings, ask questions, that sort of thing, is going out the window.
Well, the other thing, of course, is once you bring the private sector in, as is frequently the case in the Private Finance Initiative and other similar initiatives, is that you then get commercial confidentiality. Now, I would argue that any public money committed to something cannot be commercially confidential. And if people want confidentiality, then they shouldn't be bidding for public contracts.
I have to agree with you.
Yeah, they should. If you want confidentiality, you can't have a public contract. Public contracts should be public, but they're not. And we've got used to this. There's a culture of it.
I mean, Labour has said that if we get if we form the next government, that we will end the market in the NHS. The internal market is absolutely insane. We need cooperation and collaboration in the health service.
And transparency and accountability.
Oh, totally, totally.
Steve Webb, another local MP, our fight for the right to pensioners to sell off their pensions. This is also in the Post. MP Steve Webb says he'll fight to allow existing pensioners the right to sell off their remaining pensions for cash. Martin, what is this all about? And is it a good thing? I mean, certainly for most pensioners, they'll think, great, I can buy something with this and buy an asset rather than it being sitting in the
stock exchange. This again is to those that hath shall be given. Many people have no pension provision in this country. None at all. They don't earn enough wages to pay their weekly bills, so they're certainly not putting any pension pots away. So the pension pots really are for the privileged.
Pays national insurance, don't they?
Yeah, but that's
pretty much everybody.
Yeah, but they still may be in receipt of benefits. So in actual fact, it doesn't lead to anything of any substantiality. The point about this is that when you are allowed to save money for a pension, you don't pay tax on it, and there's various sweeteners to make it to encourage people to save for a pension. Now, that you can't just translate that into, we could cancel all pension provision altogether and just say people have got to save in the bank, and then they've got the money out of the bank when they want it. The point about pensions is that they're given favourable treatment. Now, that means people who haven't got pensions, and that's a substantial part of the population, will be subsidising those that have. So, in other words, this is essentially a Tory trick, even though Steve Webb's a Liberal, to boost the to boost the pockets of swing voters who are relatively well off. And at the same, just to round this off, I mean, George Osborne promised in his autumn statement that although there was no money for anything and the cuts would have to continue into the indefinite future, there would be £7 billion worth of tax cuts. Now, how completely twisted is that? So, well, there's no money for everything, but there's going to be £7 billion worth of tax cuts. You couldn't have a clearer indication of the priorities that we're talking about here. And unfortunately, the less prosperous people in the community tend not to be registered to vote. Ed Miliband yesterday was pointing out that 1 million less people are registered to vote than should be because of the changes in the regulations. These people don't register to vote, and then they're the least likely to vote. And given our first-past-the-post electoral system, that means that people like George Osborne are making a pretty cynical calculation. They're going to give free money to the wealthy classes that support them anyway.
The danger here, though, is also that it's going to leave a lot of people will blow their pension pot. If they have got a pension pot, they'll blow the lot on something and then suddenly find that they're penniless. The real problem with pensions, and it's happening because I go to public sector pensions, a public sector worker, is that people are living longer. So the original pension provisions assumed that people would live a certain amount of time and then die. And people are living longer in their old age, which means they're having to work later. But if you get people blowing their pensions in a holiday of a lifetime or a fast car that they accidentally wrap around a tree a few weeks later or whatever, then they'll suddenly find they've got no pension pot and they've still got 20, 30 years to live and they're penniless. So they'll either come back to the state and the state will have to provide for them, or nobody will provide for them and they'll be just left destitute.
Well, for a lot of families,
this is really dangerous.
They're finding that they really would like to help their younger generations to get their own property, because it's so very, very difficult now for young people, couples, etc., to get on the housing ladder. So
the problem there... Yeah, but the problem there is that we haven't been building enough houses. The amount of houses we're building in Bristol is nothing like enough. Next week's full council, Labour are going to be bringing forward a motion about actually starting to address that properly. But, you know...
Yeah, tell us a bit about that, because housing is something we're always on about here. How on earth are you going to get the City Council to start building social housing, whether it's council housing or helping housing associations, Fabian, because everybody knows we desperately need more housing, better housing in the city?
Well, we need a variety of different housing provision. I'd like to see cooperative housing, which gives people a chance to buy a stake depending on how much they can afford, rather than just a part ownership, a fixed amount. The big problem is historic. It started with the government, with Thatcher deliberately breaking up the... start introducing
the
right
to buy. We know there's a historic problem. What are you going to do about it? That's what we want to know. What's going to happen? If this Labour motion gets acknowledged and something gets done about it, what are you proposing? That's what we want to know. Not absolutely sure, right?
Not absolutely sure off the top of my head right now.
Because, I mean, I look at St Paul's, for example, and I see about 8 years ago places for people turned up. They bought loads of land in the middle of St Paul's. For example, there was a cardboard factory there that got bulldozed, rather like the places we were talking about on Temple Way, and it's been rubble ever since. Why on earth can they not build homes? I mean, we need local jobs to building those homes, and people need places to live. Families need places to live. So
it sounds to me like they're speculating on that land rather than waiting for the value to go out, rather than actually getting the houses built, which they should have been doing.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay, Martin, Fabian's drawn a blank. There is a motion at next week's full council meeting, but what do you think they should
do? Fundamental...
If I'd known I was going to be asked about it, I'd have brought it with me.
Sure, okay.
I didn't know it was going to come out.
I mean, the fundamental problem is that central government won't let local government do what local government could and in the past used to do. And I'm afraid that during the 13 years of Labour government, we didn't reverse the restrictions on council house, taking the receipts from council house sales and allowing them to be built, to be channeled into new building. I think that we did drift too far to the right of in a neoliberal consensus, which we should never have done. I mean, and then it makes it very difficult for the Labour Party after a term of Conservative government to say, "Well, we want to go back to how we used to run it." When in actual fact, when we did run it, we'd given way to this idea that somehow the private sector is going to provide all the houses in the country. There's still some delusions about that. It can't happen, and ultimately, we will have to have a mass programme of social house building.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen all sorts of awful developments going up in the last few years, but anyway, we've got a chance to do something about this in May. We've got a chance to vote in a general election, first fixed term parliament, and one of the things in the run up to that, of course, is the TV debates. Now, we've had a lot of hoo-ha over the last few weeks with David Cameron threatening to pull out of the debates if the Green Party aren't included, I don't quite know why Ofcom have decided that UKIP is okay to have in. Let's have a little discussion now, folks, about how this sort of thing should work, because I mean, you'd have thought we had a European elections last year where it was pretty clear what people, you know, and actually it's a PR election, so people are much more likely to vote for the party they really want rather than to use tactical voting. Yep. So it's a good litmus test. The Greens did very well, UKIP did very well. Surely both of them should be involved in this leadership debate. But what do you think first, Fabian?
I think Ofcom shouldn't be making this kind of decision. It should be taken outside. It should be dealt with by an independent body that has, you know, hasn't got to try and please anyone. Has just got to try and make sure everyone's fairly represented.
Why do you need an independent body? Because you obviously got with the Conservative Party, the stalking horse for them is UKIP. With the Labour Party, their stalking horse is the Greens. So
exactly, and that's why Dave Cameron wants the Greens represent there, because he wants the Greens to try and, you know, come up behind Labour. Also, David Cameron is often has the floor wiped by Ed Miliband repeatedly on Prime Minister's questions. He's obviously running scared that if he has a debate on TV with Ed Miliband, Ed Miliband will wipe the floor with him. So if he can use the Greens as an excuse to not turn up, he will,
which is fine.
I think we should just use the empty chair on him.
Come on, Ofcom. Wakey, wakey. Let's have both the Greens and UKIP. Anyway, it was all discussed at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday up at Westminster, so let's have a listen. Fabian was saying that Ed Miliband was wiping the floor with David Cameron. Let's see if he manages it this week.
In May 2010, speaking about the TV debate, a party leader said, and I quote, "It would have been feeble to find some excuse to back out." So I thought, we've got to stick at this, we've got to do it. Can you remind us who said that?
I am all for these debates taking place, but you cannot have...
The question has been asked and the answer must be heard. The Prime Minister.
I'm all for these debates, but you cannot have two minor parties without the third minor party. So I put the question to him. Why is he so frightened of debating the Green Party?
Yeah, well, Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Because actually, at the end of the day, the press has a massive amount of influence. What we get told about and what they manage to dig out about what our politicians have been up to, and particularly in the weeks and months running up to a general election, the press has a tremendous amount of influence. And it seems here they're being told, actually, no, the Green Party isn't a contender, even though they have, of course, they actually got an MP at the last general election, where UKIP didn't.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, I think the Greens should be included in the debate. But, I mean, coming back to the substantial point, Linton Crosby you're going to hear an awful lot more about him, because he is David Cameron's brain. He is actually running the Tory campaign.
He's come over here from Australia.
He does
Alistair
not.
Campbell
yes,
version,
he yeah. does not want Cameron to be debated directly. He wants to use the power of incumbency, and that the Prime Minister is somehow above the fray and all the rest of it. Because in actual fact, the Tory analysis of what happened at the last election was that allowing Nick Clegg equal time with the Prime Minister and with the Leader of the Opposition deprived the Tories of an overall majority. I think that's delusionary, actually. The Tories weren't going to get an overall majority last time, and they're not going to get one this time, no matter how much they squirm. And I think that's quite interesting, because as I understand it, the Labour Party's position is that they are prepared to have the Greens in the debate, and it's the Prime Minister who's ducking it.
Absolutely, and the bit that was missed off on that extract from question time, from the questions, was Ed Miliband saying, I'll debate anybody, and he will. So if the Greens are there, Ed will debate them, don't worry about it. So yes, I mean, personally, I've no problem with them. I think something I do have a problem with is the BBC in particular have been giving more and more disproportionately large amounts of airspace to UKIP. They haven't, and not other parties. And it's almost like, what, you know, they're almost trying to create some conflict rather than actually doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is being impartial and balanced. And we haven't seen that in particular from the BBC recently.
Interesting as well, Ofcom are a funny little organisation. They've just had a new boss who, the previous boss when he left, was talking about how the government actually was just simply doing what Rupert Murdoch told them to do, it seemed. Yep. And far too much influence of the Murdoch empire on the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. But also, they have something called a consumer panel, which is supposed to be a kind of echo space for everything they do, mm-hmm. so that us, the viewers, the listeners, can actually have our say through the consumer panel. And I phoned up Ofcom a few years ago, and one of the workers there let it slip that the consumer panel had actually been shortlisted for them by Odgers. Now, Odgers are one of the biggest corporate headhunting firms in the city that find non-executive directors for big firms. I mean, we're talking about some of the biggest FTSE 100 firms. So I don't think that that's really properly reflecting the kind of ordinary viewers and listeners at all. So come on, pull your socks up, Ofcom. I don't know if we're allowed to say that. We might get some sort of sanction for saying
be
that.
Careful,
but,
Tony.
But it's not the right way to select a proper reflective consumer panel for Ofcom.
It's absolutely right. It's completely distorted, and I think that's the danger. In some areas, you get people who are sort of the self-selected and self-appointed. When you've got an organisation like that, finding people, you know, consumers need to be. You almost need to actually sort of ask online or ask, you know, in TV breaks, they need to ask for people to sort of volunteer to go on these panels, and then fill in a questionnaire about their background and their interests and stuff, and use that to select people so you actually get something that genuinely represents the public.
I actually think with newspaper regulations and with Ofcom, what they need is people who've been wronged in one way or another by the press, because then they're a lot rather more finely tuned to the rights and wrongs of
the way the press
operates.
But also, what we've got to do is tackle media ownership. There is far too much media control in too few hands.
Well,
we need to really break that up. We had
Richard Pepier on here, the journalist from the Daily Star, who's done this film, One Rogue Reporter, basically going and doorstepping in a sort of almost Roger Cook style many of the top media editors in the country. And his approach was, well, hang on a minute, we've only got five or six people that control almost all our media. And let's not forget, this isn't just the news, the broadcasting, the newspapers and television. This is also magazines, it's also books, and also a lot of online news services as well. Yep. Of course, these big corporations have got all their own online versions of news services now. So five people, six people, that's not quite enough to have proper plurality.
It's dangerous.
Especially when most of them are Richard Desmond characters and Murdochs and the rest. Anyway, on to our next story. And MI5 came up at Prime Minister's Questions because of the fallout from the Charlie Hebdo attacks last week in Paris, in France, where several journalists and cartoonists were killed. So let's have a listen now, go back again to Wednesday, to Michael Fabricant, who brought this up at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Michael Fabricant.
In a speech last week, the Director General of MI5 identified a number of important gaps in their surveillance, which does need to be addressed by law. Now, some of these have called them a breach of civil liberties. Others have said that it's just another snooper's charter. But doesn't the Prime Minister agree with me that public safety must come above everything else? Yeah. And that civil liberty must include not being bombed, shot, yeah, or beheaded by some deranged jihadist?
Well, I agree with my honourable friend that the first duty of every government is to keep the country safe. We certainly don't do that by trashing our own civil liberties and traditions. But I believe when it comes to this vital issue of being able to have proper surveillance on the communications of potential terrorists, up until now, this Parliament and British governments have taken a very clear view. Whether it's been about looking at letters, whether it's been about fixed telephone communications or mobile communications, we have always believed that in extremis, on the production of a signed warrant from the Home Secretary, it should be possible to look at someone's communications to try and stop a terrorist outrage. And the decision I think we have to take is, are we prepared to allow in future, as technology develops, safe spaces for terrorists to communicate? The principle I think we should adopt is, no, we are not content for that to happen, and as a result, we should look to legislate accordingly.
Well, I think it's making decisions about things like telephone interception on the back of a particular atrocity is extremely badly, extremely poor policy making. Basically, we already have laws which allow interception under certain circumstances, and laws against people shooting and bombing and what have you. The question is, can you catch the people responsible? Have you got sufficient evidence? And are you looking in the right place? Don't forget that these jihadis that have been infiltrated into Syria have been armed and trained by MI6. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They've been working in Turkey and in Jordan, arming and training people who've been infiltrated into Syria to overthrow the government of Syria. There's overwhelming evidence that's the case. Now, it may well be that if we're serious about stopping terrorist attacks, we're going to have to go send the police round to MI5 and say, what are you doing in Syria? And put Colonel so-and-so and Captain so-and-so on trial. That, I'm afraid, is the serious business which the government is evading.
Fabian, what are your thoughts about this one? Because, I mean, it's just not on, is it, to allow potential terrorists to go around without their communications being snooped on?
It is, but one of the dangers, I think, you know, as Martin's just said, there are laws already in place. There is, obviously, if there are questions about, you know, if a year or so ago, Dave Cameron wanted to go in and actually send troops in to help the Islamists against the Syrian government, and it was Ed Miliband and the Labour Party who put a stop to him doing something that stupid. The problem here, one of the biggest problems you've got is when you get knee-jerk policies and sort of, you know, somebody decides something happens, some crisis happens here, there or somewhere, and immediately the government's got, you know, whoever the government is, has got to come up with an immediate new law, yeah, a new way of cracking down on it. It isn't thought out, it's done on the back of an envelope, it's dreamed up in the back of a taxi cab, and, you know, you need to be honest and actually say, we need to think this one through.
Well,
look at the laws we've got and look at the gaps, and then come back later with a considered answer.
Call me a cynic, right? But I think actually what's going on here with the Snoopers Charter is an attempt to bring within the law stuff which the signals intelligence, yeah, people at GCHQ, yeah, have been doing criminally.
That's pretty much what it looks like. The various suggestions that have been made about what the security service should be allowed to do, they're already doing it, but they've got no legal basis for it. And of course, things that are not legal are illegal. And let's not forget, I mentioned MI6 in this connection. It's quite possible that if we are serious about dealing with jihadi terrorism, we're going to have to look at our own security services and their links with these groups going back decades.
Oh, I know we were involved in
that. And that may mean putting some people on trial.
Operation Cyclone. Operation Cyclone,
indeed.
Years ago was the beginning of the whole jihadi thing. The other thing, Martin, we're talking about Paris, is that actually these guys who are allegedly behind this attack last week were actually right at the very top of the terror watch list in France. They were banned from flying. They were on the no-fly list from the UK, etc., and yet they managed to get hold of these weapons. Why haven't heads rolled at the top of the security
services?
Well,
interestingly enough as well, that the police inspector who was investigating all of this mysteriously committed suicide in his own office. There are various anomalies which we will no doubt come back into the second hour about what's happened in Paris. But what may well happen, and has certainly did happen in the past under Operation Gladio, is that various terrorist attacks were carried out, like the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, which the Italian police are absolutely convinced was carried out by NATO intelligence services. And then they come forward and say, now we need more powers to deal with terrorism, even though we are in fact the terrorists. That's what people have got to get through their heads. Often, the state that's asking for these extra powers is, in fact, implicated in the terrorist attacks that we're talking about. Now, we don't know for sure that that's what's been going on in France, but it's certainly what went on in the past.
The BBC, the MI5 have been spending quite a lot of their time and effort in wooing them, because Blue Peter is teaming up with MI5 to find Britain's spy kids. This is yesterday's Independent. Beloved BBC children's programme Blue Peter is on a not-very-secret mission from MI5 to find the next generation of spies. Project Petra, they call it, will put young viewers through their paces in a rigorous selection procedure with mental and physical challenges to rival James Bond. Three children aged between 8 and 14 will be taken on a tour of MI5 in London, Thames House, and their visit will be filmed by the CBBC show. The first time TV cameras have been allowed into the top secret building, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is kind of trying to... a bit of PR for MI5, isn't it? I mean, MI5 were accused, stand accused, of running the King Corra Boys' Home in Northern Ireland as a honey trap. So, in other words, underage boys were having sex with loyalist paramilitaries while they were being filmed by MI5. Now, this is all over the media in Belfast, and it's well known that this is what they're accused of. But, of course, that's not really... Are they really suitable people to be having young children coming around their offices? There's a question.
Fabian, what's your thoughts about this? Because over the years, of course, we've had people like Daphne Parks on the board of the BBC. We had Pauline Neville-Jones in the private security industry. It does seem that, this is a way of actually trying to win hearts and minds of young people, who many of whom actually don't trust the security services. They don't trust the MI5. And yet this is a way of kind of getting young people to think, oh, MI5 are kind of cuddly and friendly. Seems a little bit of a peculiar move.
It does seem a very, very... odd move. I'm not completely comfortable about this. I grew up watching Blue Peters, back in the 70s and early 80s. But, this does seem a little bit unusual and a bit odd. I think I'd be more interested in making sure that, MI5 and MI6 are doing what they need to do to protect the country, but don't have some of the questions that Martin's just raised hanging around them. We need to make sure that we, as the British public, can trust them to do their job in protecting us at home and abroad. That's what we need from them, and this is a little bit odd. It's a bit weird.
It's also, we've got also Rona Fairhead now running the BBC, who's from HSBC, their risk committee. Unbelievable, really, since this is the company that was doing money laundering. So lots of things seem to be going downhill with the Beeb. I just hope, the staff can manage to keep up the editorial standards with people like MI5 and HSBC ordering them around. Anyway, on to another story, and this is a little extract, actually. It was a Christmas extract from Private Eye. Government ministers are refusing to publish the findings of 60 internal reviews it's commissioned into deaths where there have been suggestions that they are related to benefit cuts or sanctions. Now, we had an extract, I think it was from the Black Triangle campaign, didn't we, just before Christmas, talking about the number of deaths due to the benefit cuts. And the government has been coming under pressure ever since the Disability News Service found out about secret investigations in the wake of the series of troubling deaths, such as that of David Clapson, who had diabetes and died in July from acute lack of insulin. His benefits had been stopped after he missed two job centre appointments. His electricity had been cut off, so the fridge where he kept his insulin was not working. An autopsy found his stomach was empty when he died. There was no food in the flat, and he had just £3.44 in his bank account. Now, this is all pretty troubling stuff, Fabian.
It's disgusting.
What do you make of it? And also, most importantly, is keeping these internal reviews into these deaths secret?
It's absolutely appalling. I'd stick IDS on trial for manslaughter, if not murder. It's these whole benefit sanction cultures, just morally obscene, as far as I'm concerned. People, if your bus doesn't arrive, say you miss your appointment because the bus doesn't turn up, or it's stuck in roadworks, you can end up losing a month's benefits. And we all know how minimal the benefits are. It's absolutely monstrous how people, this is blood on the government's hands. I'm sorry, but it really is absolutely unforgivable that, they're driving people to their deaths. Some people, people are committing suicide because of benefit sanctions. Others are like this poor man dying, and they're just sitting on it and keeping it quiet. I think once there is, hopefully, once there's a change of government, we're going to have a full inquiry into what's gone on here.
Well, I'd just like to reinforce that. Absolutely. I agree with that 100%.
So what could be done for people who really are at the limit, you know, have simply nothing, like this poor chap desperate for his insulin with no money for electricity to keep his fridge going?
I don't know.
Well, the people running the service should be geared around helping the people they're supposed to help, not trying to save money, bailing out the banks and feather-bedding the wealthy.
OK, time now for the Murdoch News at 6, we hope. Not absolutely sure if it's going to come round, because it wasn't there at 5 o'clock. But anyway, we'll keep our fingers crossed. And thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles. After the Murdoch News, another exclusive in our investigation of dirty deals done by the US and British governments at the end of World War II with the Nazis.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.